Well, my daughter just woke up and came in the room, but the buzz saws are not happening.
Okay.
So, Frida, you can watch your iPad while I'm recording this, okay? Is that cool? I like your outfit. All right. Thank you for letting me use your room. Bye. Hey, you guys, this is The Meme Podcast, and I'm your host, Kristen Filipkowski. The Meme Podcast is where I talk to creative, curious, and ambitious women who are diving headfirst into the second half of their lives. Turning 50 doesn't mean it's time to fade into the background. It means we know what we're doing, and we're not afraid to do it. Hey, everyone. I am very excited to be back with this week's Mean Show episode. Apologies for skipping last week. It was my daughter's first full week of school, and I realized pretty quickly that Zoom was not going to work for us. I was constantly basically the bad cop trying to get her to pay attention, and it wasn't happening. And I made hopefully not a rash decision to do homeschooling instead. I just didn't want to do the Zoom thing. So I've been researching curriculums, setting up an art space in the garage, buying lots of supplies at Target, and I guess I'm basically hoping that it will all make me seem like a legit teacher in my 8-year-old's eyes and my own eyes, let's face it. So wish me luck, you guys. I'm going to need it. Somewhere in there in this past week, or maybe it was even the week before, actually, I interviewed Lisa Anderson Schaefer, who is the definition of multi-talented. We met years ago at her booth at West Coast Craft, which is an amazing craft fair here in San Francisco. There's also one in LA. I will put a link to it in the show notes. It's the most beautifully edited craft fair I've ever attended. The work that is presented there is just so gorgeous, and it's really something I miss so much since this pandemic has happened. Usually there's one in the spring and in the fall. I'm hoping that maybe the one in November will still happen, but I guess we shall see. Anyway, so when I met Lisa there, she was selling her gorgeous handmade woven necklaces, and I was so impressed by her talent, and I naively thought that her jewelry business, which is called Zelma Rose, I thought that was her main gig. But what I didn't know was that she is also a psychotherapist who has worked with AIDS patients and teens in crisis, and that Lisa would go on to publish a book and launch 2 podcasts. Oh, and she's also an activist. Check out the post she wrote for Mean Magazine about how to get started in activism if you're finally fed up with the state of affairs in our country, and really, how could you not be? Anyway, the really cool thing about this episode is that Lisa makes it clear how all these seemingly disparate interests and activities fit together seamlessly, much like one of her woven necklaces. See what I did there? Sorry, guys. But anyway, it's very interesting to see how everything is really intricately entwined in her life. And it's, again, one of the reasons why I love interviewing women who are sort of at this mid-age phase where they've gotten all of this experience under their belt, and then they figure out how to piece it all together to do things that they really love and that are really fulfilling and that are also, you know, helping other people fulfill their dreams and goals. So anyway, I hope you really enjoy it, and let's get on to the show. I am so excited to have on the show today Lisa Anderson Schaefer. She is an artist, a psychotherapist, a photographer, a writer. It's a very long list. And so I am so excited, Lisa, to have you on today. Welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me, Kristen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is exciting for me because you've got so much interesting stuff going on, but also because I'm really excited to sort of get to know you better, because we've known each other for many years, but we've never like hung out or you know, talked extensively, except for that time I was on your podcast.
Right.
But I'm excited now to be asking you the questions and to get to know you better. And so I'd like to start off by saying that, you know, you're like a perfect example of why I love interviewing women who are a little bit older and more experienced, because you've accomplished so much with your career at this point and your experience is so extensive. So there's just a lot to talk about, which is awesome. So let's first talk about, you know, how did all of this get started? Like you've, like I just mentioned, you've got a lot of stuff that you're so good at and that you do. And so how did you start your career and how did each thing lead to the next? Like, was it like consecutive or were things happening at the same time, or kind of give us a perspective?
Yeah. The answer I wish I could give you would be that I had a clear trajectory the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is I still have no idea what I'm doing.
I don't believe you, but okay.
Especially now. I'm like, what is this? What are we supposed to be doing now?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like when I think about this question, I have a few number of friends who I've known since, you know, I was like 2 years old. And that's kind of an interesting thing to still be close with people who we share the same history, really.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah, it's really knowing someone in a different way. And my husband and I have been together since 1997. So we essentially like grew up as adults together. That's a long haul, but it's still different talking with someone who's kind of seen your whole metamorphosis from the time you know, you were learning to speak. For them, like when I talk to them, they're totally not surprised by anything I've done or anything I'm doing now. Like they're not thrown by, oh, you're this and this and also this. They're like, yeah, duh, of course. You were kind of always doing that. So that's an interesting perspective to have. And like for the two friends I'm thinking of, my friend Gina and my friend Christian, they sort of knew that I was an artist before I did. And it's kind of like thinking back to, you know, being in elementary school and having someone say to you, oh, you're a good artist, like a classmate or a friend. And I don't think I knew that about myself. And it took me until I was in my 20s and like had a degree in fine arts to be like, yeah, okay. That's a long pause to really stand in something from, you know, the time you're a little kid to finally be like a young adult. And, oh, okay. I get it now. Like I was the last to figure it out, I feel like.
Yeah, that just makes me think like how important like encouragement is. And, you know, for people, if you notice that someone is good at something, to like say something about it, because it takes so much convincing sometimes for the person to realize that they're talented at something.
Agreed. Yeah, it's, I think for a lot of us, our specific talents or what is of ease to us, like comes to us without a struggle, is sometimes best pointed out by someone else.
Yeah.
The one friend that I have that really will, even sort of out of the blue, just have a feeling like it's time to do something, is my friend Christian. And we've been friends since we were both 15. He was sort of the catalyst for my book. We had a conversation one day and I was like, I'm in this funk. And it's kind of funny to look back at 2016 and think of being in a funk.
You did not know what kind of funk you were about to encounter.
Right. It's hilarious. But we were there and that was happening. And I just happened to talk to him that day and he was like, I think that you are about to birth something. And I was like, how do you know? And he's like, he's like, dude, I've known you forever, so give me a little credit about what might be going on for you. So he had like very specific direction, which was tomorrow, like go in your studio, close the door, and try not to have any judgment. Just know that like something has to come out of you and don't judge how it has to come out. I'm not sure without the history that I would have received the message and that he would have felt comfortable throwing it out there.
Yeah. And that's when the book idea came?
That is the day that I went into the studio, was the day after I talked to him and I had some time by myself. My daughter must have been going, I dropped her off at camp, I think, because it was over the summer. And I closed the studio door and I just thought, I'm going to try not to judge what has to come out. And I had turned 40 that year. And I just felt like there was something I needed to say about being 40. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't coming out in any other way. Like, it wasn't coming out through painting or anything. So I sat in front of the computer, which is like the last place that I thought I would end up. And I just started writing. And that writing became the first entry to the project, which has been a daily practice that I've done for 4 years.
That's amazing. That is really cool. I actually bought the book this morning.
Yeah.
when I was, you know, cramming for our interview a little bit, I was just reading your description of the book and the purpose of it. And the sentence that really got me was something about it's a way to stop time for a minute, something like that. And that's what really got me, because I just feel like the older I get, the faster time flies by. And I'm always thinking, like, how can I make this slow down, or at least like feel like it's slowing down? And I'm excited to do this practice, and I hope that I can be disciplined enough to do it. But I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. What is it about this practice that slows down time, and how has the experience been for you over these years?
It's completely changed my life. From changing my life immediately, really within the first couple weeks, because it has yet to be an effort to feel like, oh gosh, I'm going to do this post. I have to do it. I have to do the photography, because there's a visual element to it as well, and that takes up work. I'm photographing, you know, archives of weird family heirlooms and stuff I find on my property, and so that's a piece of it too. But it's one of those cost benefit analysis things. Like, is what I'm getting out of it, even on a day when I'm like, I'm so tired, or I have nothing. I haven't learned anything today. Just from having been a psychotherapist and now working more with people in a coaching sort of business consultation way, in both instances, we're always really quick to throw away the idea of sitting with that we have nothing to contribute. That's really significant to talk about. And like in psychoanalysis, which was my wheelhouse when I was practicing, I was on this trajectory to be like a full-on analyst and go get the doctorate and do this whole thing. But I was practicing in that way without being, you know, while being licensed, but without going for the doctorate. And there's importance to, if a patient comes in and you just sit in silence and the whole hour goes by and they feel like they have to resist something or someone for some reason, it's really important that that happens and then is acknowledged. Like, so the days where I haven't learned anything or I have nothing to say, I always write that and include that as part of the project. Like, I have nothing to say today, or I hate this project today, or I really didn't want to be here and do this today. There's value in that. There's value in acknowledging our inability to contribute or show up as we would like.
That's interesting. I had a therapist once when I was younger who sat in silence. And I wanted her to take control of the session. I was like, what am I here for? Like, can you please do something? And she didn't. And it made me really angry, actually. I mean, I was in my 20s at the time, so I was, you know, a different person. But I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about what is the value there? Like, can you describe it?
That feels horrible. I was in psychoanalysis for 3 years, for three times a week in my, like, leading up to not only working with patients that way, but leading up to what I thought was going to eventually be a full-blown analyst. And it's very anxiety producing. And there's a whole, that's one level of anxiety producing. And then there's a whole way of running a group or facilitating a group, whether it's group therapy or you're facilitating a group of people in clinical training or residency, that is modeled after Bion, and where the facilitator doesn't lead, doesn't say anything. And so you're left with all these people in a room And people start to act out, right? Like someone will take control because it makes them too anxious to not sit back and kind of watch the circus act that happens. And people take on different roles. And for analysis, it's very important to sit in that quiet and acknowledge that quiet and to witness it, for the analyst to witness it, and for the patient to unconsciously know that they're of value without producing anything. Their job in showing up to an appointment is not to entertain the therapist. It's to allow for space and potential for what is going on in a deeper way. And so the analyst's sort of reason for allowing that space is to acknowledge that there's worth there without, it's a very reparative experience, no matter how it makes you feel, whether it's angry. For me, it was anxious. Like I'd go in to see my analyst and she would just say nothing. And I'd be laying there like, oh my God, like there's so much on my mind. I don't even know where to start. And then I'd say that and it would be nothing. And you know,
oh my God,
it goes on and on. But it can be a very reparative experience, because who else is going to sit with you through that?
Right. That's interesting. And so what is one question that just like sort of springs to mind is like, so what do you do with that information? Then it's the analyst's job to like do something with what happens later, or help me out here.
It depends upon the person and the individual. And there's a lot of signals that analysts receive. Mm-hmm. There's a really well-known Bay Area analyst called Thomas Ogden, and he's run clinical supervision groups in the Bay Area for decades. He's a total goddamn genius. Mm-hmm. And he came up with this concept, which I really prescribed to not only when I was seeing patients in that capacity, but I subscribe to it just in everyday life. He talks about this concept called the intersubjective analytic third, which is a total mouthful.
Okay, yeah.
But essentially what it means, he refers to it specifically in psychoanalysis, which is a very specific type of psychotherapy. Like there's many modalities, but Ogden is an analyst.
And that's when you're laying down on the couch?
Yeah, I mean, there's people that do it all different sorts of ways, but okay. The sort of traditional idea of analysis is, you know, Freud's the grandfather of analysis, and you as the patient lay down, lie down, and you are not facing the analyst.
Right.
The analyst is facing a different direction. You don't look at each other.
Yeah.
Which is a very anxiety provoking experience. And it's also very vulnerable to lie down. I mean, there were times in my own analysis where I would go in and be like, I can't lie down today.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And then we'd talk about it. Sometimes I would know why, or it would be like, I can't lie down today. And then I'd think about it and be like, I'm very anxious because da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. But Ogden in his writing talks a lot about the cues that we receive as analysts, like when we would know there will be people whose presentation, whatever they're dealing with or working through, will be to go in and for an entire month come in and not crack and just, it's a power struggle and I'm not going to give you anything.
Right.
And I want to see what you do. And as the therapist, you get these cues. So Ogden's way of thinking about some of these cues, that they're not really like flashing traffic signals. They're very subtle.
Right.
And sometimes they happen in reverie, like outside of a session, like you have a bunch of patients that day, you're on your way home from the office, you're filling the car with gas or whatever you're doing, and you just, something comes into your head and you're like, oh, next session's the time to say something because of this. Like you sort of put these puzzle pieces together. Mm-hmm. And his way of framing this through this intersubjective analytic third is that there's information. The analyst is one person, figure, thing, and the patient is another. And together they create a third, which is both of their perspectives, which exists as the separate combining of their experiences. Sort of where your minds combined and meld. It's like a little mini mind meld where what the patient is saying, how that's interpreted, what you're saying, how that's interpreted by the patient. And it becomes this third thing. that has its own kind of perspective and can be thought about from the analyst perspective. I always appreciated that Ogden called it something. I find it unfortunate. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do the Joy Is Now podcast is to just have conversations about psychology. I just get the feeling that people have a lot to say and think about it, but there's not a lot of information shared from kind of the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this is so interesting because to me, it's making it so clear, like how you went from psychology, from that importance of the nothing space sort of to the These Three Things book. And now it's sort of fishtailing into why you created the podcast. So you're making it very clear how this is all related. So let's talk about the podcast. I love talking about psychology. I am not by any means an expert on it at all, but I've done a lot of therapy.
always fun and always horrible, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've benefited from it a lot. Like I actually feel like my life would be totally different. Like I'd probably be divorced if I hadn't gone to therapy.
I think that's true for many of us. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, relationships are hard, man.
Yeah.
We kind of act like it's. I just had a conversation with someone, an interview for the podcast, and we were talking about how just kind of unbelievable it is. And this is so general, like this is just so big and vast, that we tend to have the assumption that our relationships will be replicated, right? So like you and I are probably under the assumption right now that our relationship with someone else will be similar to the relationship between you and me. And it's like totally different people with different, you know, narratives and stories and energy and history and their own relationships but we kind of think like, oh, there's a way relationships go. And a good relationship with everyone feels this way. And a bad relationship with everyone feels this way. And it's like, that can't possibly be true. There's just too many, you know, if you look at it on paper, there's too many random factors. Everything from like how much sleep we both got the night before to, you know, lifelong, like, history, narrative, the stories we tell ourselves, our own fact versus feeling, like all of that.
Wow. Yeah. That is so interesting because it just occurred to me, like if you acknowledge that your friendship or whatever kind of relationship is likely to not be the same as your previous relationships, it might just like open up the possibilities for you so much more. Because I think a lot of times we, just speaking for myself, maybe like shut down.
Yes.
If, you know, if it's not going this like certain way you think it's supposed to go, you're just like, oh, well, I guess we're just not going to be friends, or I guess this isn't going to work out. But if you sort of are more open-minded about it and acknowledging what you just said, there seems like there could be so many more possibilities for relationships.
The more that I talk to people and I do the interviews for the podcast, the more I realize, which is surprising because I feel like I had a pretty good beat on psychology going into it.
Yeah.
But I'm realizing exactly how, and this is one of the things that I just gravitated towards with psychoanalysis in terms of other modalities, is that psychoanalysis in general does a good job of doing a wide focus and a narrow focus simultaneously. So there's always this, and that's sort of what analytic third, intersubjective analytic third is referring to, like the narrow focus of that session would be what the patient is saying, what Ogden is saying, right? That's kind of the narrow, what's happening in the now. And then if you're taking the wider focus is all of this narrative and story and exchanges and a million different ingredients in the soup, right?
Yeah.
Analysis is very seamless for me. I think maybe other people might get that from that practice other modalities, but it really does that for me to constantly go, okay, well, this is what's right in front of us, but what if we like step back and really think, wow, so our expectation is that every relationship we have is going to go the same way, and that's how we judge whether a friendship or a romantic relationship or a sexual relationship, like whatever kind of relationship it is, like we judge that with a person that's entirely unique, who our stories and our narratives intertwine with theirs in a unique way. we judge that based on relationships we've had with other people. And of course you want to, have like quote unquote standards, right? You don't want to be in a relationship where someone treats you poorly outright. Like these are, we want to have appropriate boundaries when we are vulnerable with other people, but that assumption really doesn't give us this fluidity of space to kind of not only allow ourselves to come as we are, but also accept other people coming to us as they are.
Yeah, that is such a great way to look at relationships. I'm thinking about, so just over these past couple days, our 20-year-old brought home a dog, a puppy, after he was told he was not allowed to do that.
Bold move.
And so that probably sounds very out of the blue. I don't mean to like totally go from left field, but I am such a softie. I'm like, that puppy is so freaking cute. Like I want it in my life, but my husband is totally against it. And it has caused this like, you know, you can imagine like major friction between the two of them. And to the point where the 20-year-old is like, you know, he's so weird. I can't stand him. Like just stuff like about the relationship, you know, that is just all coming to a head. And, you know, it's like, he's just not the way I want him to be. And that's happening from the other side as well, you know? And it's just like, it seems like all these, I mean, we need an intervention. I really feel like, oh my God, this is really coming to a head and we need a third party in here. But yeah, it's just all that relationship stuff that you were just describing is just so important to remember when things get come into conflict, it seems like. I know what I'm, but if you.
No, but, I think conflict is big and, you know, kids, especially that age, like, that's just that older adolescent age is just like so fat. Like it makes me salivate to just think about the mind at that point in time.
Well, you are definitely coming from a different perspective, like cower in fear.
Trust me, it's awful for all those directly involved. And then if you kind of, if you're on the outside and it's a mind, it's a stage of development that you can appreciate because of the chaos and of all the reasons that make it 100% miserable to live with. You know, there is a...
But also rewarding and fun in other ways. You know, it's wonderful and horrible at the same time.
Totally. And I think that's pretty much everything. I think that's what we've got.
Yeah. This is actually something I've always wanted to ask a therapist, but I've never had the opportunity to.
Yeah, ask away, because I'll be really honest about it too, which might not go down well with the therapy community.
I mean, I don't know if this is interesting to other people as well, but I'm just curious, sometimes when you're in therapy, whether it's a kid or an adult, and you're listening to them, and they're just going on and on. Cause I know that sometimes when I'm talking to my therapist, I'm just talking about myself and I'm going on and on and on. And I'm like, if this was a friend, they'd be annoyed or bored out of their mind. And so I'm wondering, does that happen to you? Are you just kind of like, oh my God, when are they going to stop talking? or is it more of like, well, this is interesting because you're looking at it from a professional perspective? Or I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. Well, so Ogden, this would be a really great example to talk about the intersubjective analytic third. Ogden would say that if you are having those feelings as the analyst and someone is going on and on, sometimes there's something called perseverating that happens, which a person will go over and over, just perseverate on the same thing.
I shouldn't laugh, but I feel like I just do that sometimes.
We get in those places of stress where like that you get stuck in the loop, right? The feedback loop. And so there's that. And when something like that is happening, that's sort of like a very surface level thing that's happening. And a therapist might say, I noticed that we're kind of coming back to this multiple times and we seem to be stuck here.
Yeah.
But in terms of something else, like any feeling that, and this is from a psychoanalytic perspective, any feeling that the analyst is feeling when the patient is talking becomes part of this analytic third to think about and to talk about.
Right. Right.
And it depends on how, well, it depends on it, to be perfectly honest, it depends on the relationship with the patient, how long you've been working with them, because it's not so much about you being bored. Like analysts would say that that's a message.
Okay.
That's a message. Is the patient actually feeling that themselves? Is this giving you a message of how the patient makes other people they have relationships feel? It's it's always a message. And that's kind of that's what's so intellectually stimulating to me about the profession, is that it's kind of like you're always in the mystery machine with the Scooby-Doo gang. Like you're looking for the clues.
That's so cool.
And you don't always see them the first time, but one of sort of internal rules of the profession is that your client will give you another opportunity. It's never, oh, I missed it. You know, like I was saying, you might, you know, you're filling up the car on the way back from the office or something. And you think, oh man, that was the message that was the message they were trying to give me. And I missed it. And then it becomes, do you bring it up next time? It really depends on the, like where you are in the therapy, your relationship with the client. Is it someone that would be receptive to being like, you know what? You really gave me an opportunity to say something last time. And I didn't. And I have a lot of feelings about that. Or is it the type of thing where you don't say anything, you kind of use that acknowledgement on your part as information, right? Like clues, so that when it does happen again, and the window does open a little bit, you like jam your hand in there and you open it wide up because you've kind of been waiting. You're like, okay, here it is. And then you go, wow, da-da-da-da-da-da. And the person either gets it, you offer up the intervention, the person's either ready to hear it or they're not. And the window opens wider or it slams shut. And then you wait again. Or you say, I noticed that I said something that I thought might have made a lot of sense to you and you didn't hear it. What, you know, is that about anything? Sometimes it is, sometimes it, you know, you kind of make the judge about, I don't know why I'm using Scooby-Doo as a metaphor. It's kind of making me laugh, but you're kind of making the judgment call over and over again, when to like pull the mask off, like when to reveal, like it was the creepy groundskeeper, you know?
That's so funny. Well, that's interesting. That makes sense that you would sort of come at it like you're like, it's an investigation, like an ongoing investigation. That's interesting.
It is. And not like a weird way, but just in like a, I guess what I think patients don't realize or clients don't realize the therapist is doing is not making value judgments on what the person is saying or what the therapist is feeling. So it's because it's informative. It's not like, oh my gosh, every time this person talks about this, I feel really aggravated. It's like, well, there's a reason why. So it's not a bad thing. It's informative. It's not, that's where the science comes in, right? Where you're like, there's no value judgment based on this. It's information. And so you need to use it.
Yeah, I love that. That's really cool. Maybe I'll go back to school to become a therapist. No, I'm just kidding. But it was, so just to circle back to the podcast, I want to make sure people know didn't launch yet, right? When will it launch?
Very soon. Very soon. I have a couple of episodes in the hopper. So I'm hoping by the end of this week, I can actually have the little intro episode so that it will just have a place on Apple and Spotify and all the things. But it's called Joy Is Now.
Okay.
Which is a name that I was very surprised it was going to be called, but
why? Why were you surprised?
It's like very upbeat, I think.
Yeah.
And I think in naming it that, what I really wanted to do was take, like, level the playing field about psychology. Like, you don't have to be an expert to talk about human behavior. Like, yes, there is a study of it, and there are people that do it professionally. And there's reasons why you go to see them, many of which, you know, we've discussed today. But you also, like, let's talk about it. Let's have it be more part of just our communities, like just talking about psychology and the feelings that we feel. And it doesn't have to be in a professional way. Like, I do three different types of episode segments. And one is where I write sort of an analytic perspective on a theory or an idea. And I just read it and I talk about it myself. And then there's two other episode segments. One where I have a guest come on to talk about an emotion of choice. So people have talked about everything from rage to, you know, more nuanced things, guilt, different things like that. And that's just me, you know, I present some information, whether there's a neuropsych connection, like with rage, there's a pathway in the brain and there's a circuit that the body goes through. But with other things, I usually present some psychoanalytic theory about it. And then we just talk about it. Like, what do you think about this? Like, you don't need to be a therapist or a college professor or anything to have an opinion on an emotion that you feel.
Right.
And we all, psychology is the thing that we all have in common, right? So let's like talk about it like it is something we have in common.
Yeah.
Because it often becomes this like hot potato that no one wants to deal with and no one wants to manage. And it's like, it's a hot potato for every single one of us. So the other segment, these three things, is where people bring in three life lessons that have stuck with them. And sometimes that involves some psychology, sometimes not. Sometimes we just talk about a quote. Sometimes people bring in a quote or a piece of music or something that they learned from someone they worked for years ago that, you know, they're now managing a team and they talk about that with their team, stuff like that. And there's a psych piece about it. But the thing I like about that segment is it's a very casual way of us talking about what's important to us and that those things ultimately involve behavior and involve emotion and involve psychology in some way, shape, or form. Like, even if it's a song, like the song makes you feel a certain way. Why is it important?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Well, I am very excited for the episode that I'm going to be on. And it was very interesting to sit down and think about the three things, the three life lessons, sorry. Yeah. It was a really interesting exercise to sit down and do that. I really sort of enjoyed doing it and I spent probably way too much time on it, but I'm just really excited that it's a cool platform that you're giving people to like talk about this. And I think it will be really interesting for listeners as well.
I hope so. I hope that people can take the experience and then feel like, okay, so if I opened myself up to three things I've learned over a lifetime, what if I opened myself up to three things I learn each day?
Yes. Oh, and I'm excited to do that too. Wow. Well, we discussed a lot of the stuff that you do, except for Zelma Rose.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. And that's how we first met.
I know. It's really funny.
Yeah. We met at, was it Renegade Craft Fair or one of the craft fairs?
Was it Renegade or West Coast Craft, something like that?
One of them. Like, I know I've seen you at all of them, and you create these gorgeous pieces of fine jewelry and you make them. It's macrame, is that correct?
Yeah, I call it macrame because that's what people, that's sort of a category that people can easily put it in. Macrame is traditionally knots. And the pieces that have become sort of a signature of the Zelma Rose collection are actually woven, but it's a very fine, like that's a very fine distinction. So when people are like, it's macrame, I'm like, yeah.
So where does Zelma Rose fit into your trajectory? Like, when did you start? You went to art school, so art has been a part of your life for a while.
Yeah, I have a BFA from the San Francisco Art Institute in Russian Hill in San Francisco. And I was a working artist for about 8 years before I went to graduate school for psychology. I spent most of my career outside of school working as an artist in residence through the California Arts Council. And I was in residency at Mount Zion Hospital, which in the 90s still had an AIDS ward, believe it or not. I was doing artwork at the bedside with adults who were dying of AIDS, which is incredible to think about. And they were just in the process of really building what has become a world-renowned cancer center. So it was a fascinating time to be there to kind of watch their trajectory go from this small, you know, Mount Zion was this small community hospital that existed so that Jewish doctors could find work when they couldn't work at other hospitals.
Because no one would hire them.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So it has like a very deep history as meeting the needs of the community that was around it. And then to kind of start there with that, I was doing artwork at the bedside with, like I said, people who were dying of AIDS, with people who were going through cancer treatment. And then I did other things, like I did some mural projects, like artist in residency type stuff. And I did that for a while. And then this is like such a bizarre like notch on the timeline of my trajectory there. But when 9/11 happened, the Arts Council, like many other arts grant funded programs, went under.
Oh, yeah.
Because no one was funding the arts. So they were kind of like, we can't pay, you know, we can't pay to do the work. And the people that I was working with at UCSF were amazing. And they were like, we can keep you here till the end of the year. But then, like, you know, we were working with the Arts Council because it's not a position that, you know, we're funding fully. And so I stayed to the end of that. And then I thought, okay, so realistically, how long is this money going to not be there? And when priorities shift, and certainly now as priorities are shifting, grant funding that goes to programs like that, they're not funded for years. Like, it's not just a year. It's like 5 years at minimum. So I knew that that's kind of what I was up against. And I thought, is there anything else I want to do? So that's where psychology came in. I went and got a master's in clinical psych because I was working, there was a lot of psychology involved in what I was doing as an artist at the hospital.
Okay.
And so that met up with that. And I went to, got my master's, did my 3,000 hours to sit for my licensing exams, got like such an incredible job that I loved, and went into private practice. And then when it came down to starting a family, I honestly felt, well, I was working with adolescents, both younger adolescents, like teenagers, and older adolescents, college-aged kids who were in acute crisis, which I, like, I loved that work. I still love that work. But for me, emotionally, it's too much to do and be a parent. And I kind of knew that about myself. Like, I think I was, we were kind of coming down the pike about starting a family. And I was like, and not only that, it was like, my partner had signed up for me to have that kind of emotional availability where, like, you know, there'd be court dates and meet, you know, there's a lot involved sometimes with that population. And he had signed on for that as my partner and as another adult I had, but I was talking about bringing someone into this world that hadn't, like, agreed to mom has to go here or there, you know, like suddenly.
Right.
And I was like, I don't know how I feel about that. So I came home from my office one day and I had a conversation with my husband in the kitchen. And I said, I think I'm done. I don't think I can do this anymore. And he looked at me and he said, I don't think you've been happy for a really long time. And I was like full on ugly cry, like fell to the floor. Like, I knew in that moment he was right. I was like, wow, like, you know, I had gotten the job. I thought I always wanted this and this, but there was something that wasn't working. And I think it was the intensity of the work that I was doing.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people that are very capable of doing that. It turns out I'm not long term. Mm. So I had to reconcile with that. And then, you know, we were both standing in the kitchen like, so now what? Because you can't just leave a practice. Like, I had to, you know, take a leave and I had to refer my patients elsewhere. Like, it's at least a year long process. So it's a long process. And what else were you going to do? So I went back to teaching art right away because it's very easy to get a job as an art teacher if you have been able to control the room of 18 teenagers in a psychiatric hospital.
Wow.
People are like, oh, yeah, you'll be fine.
Very good experience. Yes.
Yeah. And I was, so I did that. And then around the same time was like, okay, what, like, how do I want to enter back into art? And I had been like such a fine artist. I mean, I showed my photography and did multimedia works and had this whole body of work and did solo shows and all that. And I was like, how do I want to re-enter into this? Like, I actually have a choice to enter in a different way. And I had never made a product. So I kind of wanted to try that. And that I started playing around with ideas like, is it a chair? Am I making a chair? What is it? And the jewelry thing just kind of happened organically and started the, you know, also disturbing enough that, like, the basic cost benefit analysis, like, let's just say I was going to go back to my private practice after my kid was born in 2009, 10, 11, around that time. If I had gone back to my practice with commuting time, with the number of patients I'd be able to realistically see with a newborn and childcare and insurance and my office, I would be making $75 a week. And I was being paid on the higher end of what a therapist gets paid even then. I was making more than some therapists get paid now.
Wow.
And it was $75 a week. And Matt just looked at me and he was like, I think you could make $75 a week doing almost anything else.
Yeah. That would be not nearly as taxing on your psyche.
Right. And right. I would be home, because when we looked at it on paper, it was like, who can we hire with my qualifications to take care of my kid? No one. And that was, and like, yes, I wanted to do it and all of that, but like, if we were being really dry about it. And so at like the whole beginning of Zelma Rose was like, can I make $75 a week? And yeah, at first I did. And then it became easier to make more money. And then it really turned into a business, but it's, I started in 2010. So it's been 10 years.
Wow.
And she's kind of her own machine, she's her own thing and keeps going. And yeah.
I think you mentioned that you're making some changes to Zelma Rose.
Yeah, I'm excited. So Jamie Tarr, who I do the Biased Cuts sartorial podcast with, she and I are accountability partners when it comes to our fashion design businesses. And when the pandemic hit and sort of everything was out on the table, Jamie and I looked at each other and we're like, well, what do you want to do? Like, how do you, forget about cost, forget about anything, forget about risk. Like, the risk has been vomited all over us at this point, for all of us, the risk, whatever. Like, how do you really want to run things? And so she had a list of things that she wanted to do. And I ultimately came up with a list of things that I wanted to do. And my goal was to change the way people shop online. I did not want to do wholesale anymore. I wanted to do direct to consumer. And so I decided that I was going to go with a model that I called Pay What Feels Good. So there's a section of the Zelma Rose website called The Edit. And if you are a newsletter subscriber, you can put your email in right there to shop. But there's a subscriber or an edit member of the website now where you can pay what feels good. So each design has three options. There's one option that's below retail, and that's about 15% less than the retail price. But now the retail price includes a $10 donation to Color of Change.
Oh, cool.
That I make from the retail price. So like, if we're talking about the Estero necklace, that's $225 retail price. So that is maintained as the retail price, but within that is a $10 donation to Color of Change. So then the actual retail price becomes like $215, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one option. And then the other option is $10 over retail price, of which $5 goes to patronage for the Bias Cuts podcast. And then $5 goes to Color of Change. So you're becoming a patron of the projects that I have going on through Zelma Rose, and then also a donation towards Color of Change. And I just felt like that was the model that I wanted to move forward with, was like, let's have shopping feel good. And when you buy something, because it's doing the work is hard and it doesn't matter. It's like, so what? But there's a lot of different entryways to do the work. And if the work that you want to do is through donation, then that's great. If the work that you want to do is protest demonstrations, that's great. Like, just enter into the stream of work. And, I do make, for years, I've made annual donations to Team Rubicon, the One Campaign. I work with them too. This year I added Color of Change, but I've always donated percentage of sales to organizations I believe in every year. But I felt like now is a time for people to pay what feels good, make a choice. Like, if it's below retail price, fine, that's available for you. But if it's the retail price, then know that there's $10 that's going to a very well-run organization that's really good at doing the work. Like, they're excelling at doing the work, instead of, just kind of talking about it or being performative about it.
Yes. Well, that's amazing. I mean, and I know you have a long history with activism. You've written a piece for Mean Magazine, which I'll highlight in the show notes.
Yeah, that was fun.
I was so grateful that you did that. It was really like practical, helpful advice for getting started. I definitely trust the organizations that you've chosen to support with Zelma Rose.
Yeah, I don't know how it's going to go. It could be a tremendous success or it could be a total failure, but it was like, I'm going to try it now. Like, this is how I really want people to shop, is this model. I also really want to offset the carbon emissions from my shipping. So I added that. Like, I just looked at everything. I was like, these are all the things I want to do. It's either, you know, going to work really well or it's going to be a bust, but this is it. This is how I really want it to go.
That's great. And your products are already completely sustainable and environmentally safe with you use non-toxic dyes. I was really happy to hear that or to read that you use the Dharma Trading dyes because those were the ones that I bought to do my little ice dyeing projects, but I didn't know that much about them. So then when I saw that you use them, I was like, oh, good. They're safe and a responsible company.
Yeah, Dharma's been around since the 60s and they have a really ethical supply chain.
So let me just ask you the question that I always ask everyone at the end of the interview is, what is the best thing about getting older?
Oh, by far, letting go of just an enormous bag of bullshit.
Yes, and agree with that.
You know, we all have them. Like, it's part of our narrative. It's part of our story. But and you and I have talked about this, like, something happened to me. I had friends that when they turned 40, and this is going back a handful of years from me now, but they were like, oh, 40 is like something happens when you're 40. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
That's nice. But it really was like the day after my 40th birthday, it was like I took that big bag of BS and like emptied half of it out and didn't look back. I was like, okay, that trash is staying here now. I'm not bringing it with me anymore. And that felt so good. And it wasn't like it didn't come through therapy. It didn't come through like thinking. It was just experience of being like, why have I been carrying this? This is stupid. Later.
Yeah. Oh, good for you. Doesn't that feel so good?
Oh, and it never came back. I kept thinking like, oh, I'll wake up one morning and think that everyone can see how veiny my hands are. It's like, no, I'm still waiting.
Sorry to laugh, but yeah, that's just one of those things that you're just like, everyone's looking at my whatever. And it's like, no, they're not.
No,
and who cares if they are?
Right. If they are, right? Who cares? Like, who cares?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you're like a decade ahead of me because I didn't really experience that until I turned 50, but at least I got there. I guess I can take comfort in that.
Yeah. I think that's the important part is to get there. Yeah. And I don't know if everybody does. Like, I'm curious. I mean, I know that most of my friends have because we talk about it. We're like, oh my gosh, remember like being so obsessed about the stupidest stuff? Yeah. Oh my God. That was a waste of time. Yeah. Like, you don't, I wish you could cut the line, but you don't get to cut the line of experience. It's like development. Like, you can't skip phases. You gotta just kind of.
That's so true. I've been looking at a lot of old pictures lately of myself, and I'm just like, look at my cute little self. Like, why was I so hard on myself? Like, I had so much insecurity and like just judged myself so harshly. And I look at myself and I'm like, I was fine. I was great. Like, it's, but you know, like you said, you can't, it's 2020 hindsight or whatever. You just can't skip ahead.
It's hard. I mean, it definitely is a complication of raising a daughter to be like, can we skip this? I don't know if this house we can. It'll be interesting to see.
I so try to not give her a glimpse into my insecurities and, you know, when I'm trying to lose weight, you know, like mainly because I want to fit into my clothes. I don't want to buy all new clothes.
Yeah.
but I don't want to be like, oh, I'm on a diet and I can't eat that because of that. You know, I don't want to say it out loud in front of her because I don't want her to take on that psychosis or whatever.
Yeah. You know? And it's bizarre with kids too. My friend and I talk about this all the time. It's like, you never know what's going to sink in.
Mm-hmm.
She was telling me that like, I think we were talking about Star Wars. This was a couple of years ago. And our kids were both kind of at that point, like, are we going to do the new Star Wars movie or what? Like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
So I think she had kind of went into this preparation mode of like prepping the kids, like, we're going to go see this movie and this is what the story, like this whole long thing to kind of yeah. like, you know, to give it some context, right? Mm-hmm. And so they go see the movie, like makes, you know, of course the kids love it, but there's zero, any of the things she was worried about, none of it happened. Like, they're in the car and like they see something weird happen in like a Target park, like a cart runs away from a car and hits a tree and falls over and like the eggs break, like something bizarre like that.
Mm-hmm.
Totally stayed with her kids for weeks. And she was like, this is nuts. This is nuts. Like, I spent all this time. And then like she and I had a conversation about like, what are you saying about Star Wars? You know, it's not. And then she's driving by Target and like a cart hits a tree and the eggs fall out. And the kids are like, oh, super impacted by that.
That is so funny. That reminds me of one more quick story. I know I'm like taking up way too much of your time, but that's similar to when my kid was in preschool, which seems like yesterday. It was like a few years ago. They had, you know, not show and tell. They called it sharing. They had their like their special share day. Like each kid would have a day. And Frida one day wanted to bring in her broken doll. It was like a Barbie doll, but it was missing a leg. And I think it was an Ariel doll, like a mermaid Ariel doll.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you sure you want to bring the broken one? Like, okay. And so she brings it in and she shares it. And the kids are like fascinated by the missing leg. They're oh my God, well, what happened? How did she lose her leg? Oh my God, let me see. I want to see that. They were like more excited than anything I think she ever brought in, you know, like the flashiest, most exciting toy. The missing leg Ariel Barbie doll was like the thing. It's just like, yeah, you never know what's going to stick with them. It's so funny.
Yeah, it's hard to, I mean, even like abiding by all the quote unquote things, like, you know, I don't want to talk about not eating something, you know, like those things, it's generally out there. Like, that's not the best idea, but like even abiding by those things, like having it be overheard once could have, it's just like, you know, you never know. So it's like, you just try to do the best you can and hope for the best.
She has already said, like recently, this is the first time she said anything like this. She said something like that she was happy that at least she has a thin body or something like that. And I was like, what? No. Like, where did, you know, it's just watching stuff. It's out there.
Yeah. And then you go, you're like, oof, that was such a kick in the gut. Cause I'm so careful.
Lisa, this has been so much fun. Such an interesting, like wide ranging conversation. I can't thank you enough for taking the time and talking about all your fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love to talk to you. I could talk to you for like days and still find a million interesting things to find out about you.
I know. Well, back at you, like, I feel like I could go, we've been here for an hour and a half. I feel like I could go at least another hour and a half, if not way more.
Totally. So,
but I will let you get on with your day. Thanks again so much. Thanks so much for listening to the Mean Podcast. Please check out the online magazine at www.meanmagazine.com. And get in touch if you or someone you know should be featured in the magazine or on the podcast.